I want to start today with a mental image for you. Picture the intellectual world of the Middle Ages.
Okay, setting the scene.
Yeah, it's pretty locked down, right? It's relatively stable. Everyone has their books, their traditions, their basic understanding of how the universe works. And then just boom, a massive collision.
It really was an intellectual earthquake.
Right. It's kind of like finding an alien spaceship in your backyard, and it just happens to have way better technology than you do. Because suddenly the works of Aristotle, this ancient Greek genius, are rediscovered by the West.
And you'd think the authorities would be thrilled.
You would. Like, hey, more knowledge. We love books. Let's put them in the library. But instead, it triggered a massive existential crisis. Why was Aristotle such a threat to them?
Well, you really have to look at the baggage that came with him. Because Aristotle wasn't just a guy with some, you know, some mildly interesting ideas. He offered a complete, incredibly rigorous system of logic, of physics, and metaphysics.
The whole package.
The whole package. But he was a pagan. He didn't have the Bible. He didn't know about Genesis. So his system arrived with some conclusions that, well, they just didn't play nice with Christian theology.
But like the idea that the universe is eternal.
Right.
That it had no beginning.
Exactly. And this is where that specific group, the Averroists, comes into the picture.
The Latin Averroists. We see them mentioned a lot in the source material.
Right. They were followers of the Islamic philosopher Averroes, who had written these massive commentaries on Aristotle. And they looked at these glaring contradictions between Aristotle's pristine logic and the teachings of the church. And they proposed a solution that, frankly, drove the church authorities up the wall.
Because it was a terrible solution.
It was a fascinating but deeply problematic solution. They called it the twofold truth.
Which is, what does that even mean? Is it like having a split personality?
It essentially is. They argued that something could be absolutely undeniably true in philosophy, if you're following reason and Aristotle, but that exact same thing could be simultaneously false in theology.
That is wild.
Right. So you could stand in a university lecture hall on a Tuesday and say, well, according to reason, the world is eternal and was never created.
And then what? You just walk across the street to Mass on Sunday.
And you say, I believe in God, the Father Almighty, creator of heaven and earth.
That sounds incredibly convenient for the academics. Just, you know, don't blame me. Blame the discipline I'm currently standing in.
It was convenient, yes, but it was also incredibly dangerous for the intellectual fabric of the time. It fractured reality. It basically suggested that faith and reason were enemies, just living in completely different realities.
And the church obviously couldn't have that. Truth has to be one thing. You can't be a schizophrenic believer.
Exactly. Enter Thomas Aquinas.
Enter our hero of the day.
Thomas looks at this entire mess, this giant academic train wreck, and he just says, no.
He rejects it.
He does, but he does it brilliantly. Because he refuses to reject Aristotle, the logic is just too good, the science is too advanced to ignore, but he also utterly refuses to accept the twofold truth nonsense. So he sets out on this incredibly ambitious mission to synthesize them.
It sounds almost like a hack. Like he wants to take the very weapon that's being used against the church, this sharp Aristotelian logic, and use it to essentially prove the Christian God.
Baptizing Aristotle is often how scholars describe it. He wants to show you that if you think clearly enough, if you push your reason to its absolute rigorous limit, you don't end up an atheist or pagan.
You end up right at the doorstep of the Creator.
Precisely. For Aquinas, reason and revelation are not enemies. They are best friends. They are two different paths climbing the exact same mountain.
Okay, so let's dig into how he actually pulls this off. Because I have to admit, when I think of proving that God exists, I usually think, well, isn't it just obvious to religious people? Don't most believers just start with God exists and now let's move on to other things?
That is exactly how many people felt back then, too. And actually, there's a very strong tradition prior to Aquinas, the Platonic tradition, championed by heavyweights like St. Augustine and St. Anselm, that leaned heavily in that direction.
They felt it was just obvious.
They felt the knowledge of God was sort of implanted in us, innate.
I think I've heard of this. Is this that famous argument where you just sit in a chair, close your eyes, imagine the most perfect being possible, and then logic dictates that he has to exist?
That's the one. That is Anselm's ontological argument. The basic premise is that if you can conceive of, quote, that than which nothing greater can be conceived, it must exist in reality.
Because if it only existed in your imagination, it wouldn't be the greatest.
Exactly. A real existing thing is by definition greater than a purely imaginary thing.
So you can essentially prove God exists without ever opening your eyes. You don't need to look at a tree or a star or anything. You just look inside your own mind.
Right. It's what philosophers call an a priori argument. It proceeds from the mind alone prior to any sensory experience. But Aquinas, he completely rejects this.
He rejects it. Why? That seems like a pretty handy argument to have in your back pocket.
Because he's an Aristotelian. He is fundamentally an empiricist. Aquinas believes that human beings start out as blank slates. We do not come preloaded with software or innate, perfectly formed ideas of God.
So how do we know anything?
Everything we know, we have to get through our physical senses first. Sight, touch, hearing. If it's not in the senses first, it can't be in the intellect.
And for Aquinas, we can't just close our eyes and find God. We actually have to open them and look at the world.
Precisely. And he makes a really crucial distinction here. He says, yes, in himself, God's existence is totally self-evident. God is his own existence. But, and this is the key, it is not self-evident to us.
Because we aren't God.
Because we are finite creatures. We cannot see God's essence directly. So Aquinas says we have to do this the hard way. We have to start with what we can see, the rocks, the motion of the planets, the cows in the field.
And work our way backwards.
Yes. From the effects back to the hidden cause. This is the a posteriori approach.
Which brings us to the famous five ways. Now, I'll be honest with you, and for you listening at home, you might feel the same. When I read lists of philosophical proofs, my eyes usually glaze over. It feels like a dry logic puzzle. But looking at the source material we have here, the lecture by Dr. Holmes, Aquinas is doing something pretty clever with the physics of his day.
He really is. He's meeting his intellectual opponents entirely on their own turf. He takes premises that any hardcore Aristotelian would accept as basic science, and he shows step by step how they lead inevitably to a totally non-Aristotelian conclusion.
Let's pick one apart to see how it works. The argument from motion. To a modern person, this just sounds like basic Newtonian physics. Things move, a ball rolls.
Yeah.
So what? How does that prove God?
Well, you have to understand motion the way a medieval Aristotelian did. It's not just location like a car driving down the street. Motion is change. It's the reduction of potentiality to actuality.
Okay, slow down.
Yeah.
The reduction of potentiality to actuality. Give me a real world example of what that looks like.
Sure. Take a block of marble. It is actually a block of marble right now, but it is potentially a statue.
Okay.
But that marble can't make itself into a statue, can it? It needs something external. It needs a sculptor to act upon it with a chisel. The sculptor reduces the potentiality, the mere possibility of being a statue, to actuality. The finished, carved statue.
Okay, that makes total sense. The marble doesn't just wake up one morning and decide to be Michelangelo's David. It needs a push.
Exactly. And Aquinas argues that whatever is moved must be moved by another. You cannot be potentially something and actually something at the exact same time in the exact same respect. You can't be both the sculptor and the raw marble simultaneously. Mm. So if you trace this chain of movers back, the statue was moved by the sculptor. The sculptor's arm was moved by his muscles. His muscles were moved by his nervous system. And so on, you eventually hit a logical wall.
You can't just keep going back forever.
Aquinas argues that an infinite regress of movers is impossible. If there is no first mover to start the entire chain, then there are no subsequent movers at all.
If you don't have an engine at the front of the train, the caboose doesn't move.
Exactly. So by sheer logical necessity, you must arrive at a first mover, a mover that is put in motion by absolutely nothing else, pure actuality.
But wait a minute. Aristotle believed in a first mover too, didn't he? I thought that was part of his system. So Aquinas hasn't actually proven the Christian God yet. He's just proven Aristotle's God.
You've hit on the exact crucial point. Aristotle's God, the prime mover, was.
Well, it wasn't exactly a God you'd pray to or ask for forgiveness.
Was it that thought-thinking itself concept?
Yes. Aristotle's God was strictly a final cause. Think of it like a giant cosmic magnet.
A magnet. Yes. A magnet doesn't physically reach out and push a piece of metal, right? It just sits there, perfectly being itself, and the metal is drawn toward it by attraction. Aristotle's God didn't even know the universe existed. It was just perfect, self-absorbed thought, contemplating its own perfection. It attracts the universe, but it doesn't create it, and it certainly doesn't care about it.
So how on earth does Aquinas get from that cold, self-absorbed magnet God to a loving creator?
He shifts the parameters of the argument. He looks at efficient cause. An efficient cause is the agent that actively makes things happen. He argues that this first mover isn't just a goal or a magnet. It has to be an agent. It's a who, not a what. And he links this specifically to the concept of necessity.
Necessity. That's another one of the five ways from the text.
It is. Think about us. You and I are contingent beings. We exist, sure, but we didn't strictly have to exist. There was a long time before we were here, and there will be a time after we're gone. We are possible, but we are not necessary.
We're basically lucky accidents.
In a metaphysical sense, yes. But Aquinas argues that if absolutely everything in reality were like us, merely capable of existing or not existing, then given infinite time, at some point absolutely nothing would have existed.
And if there was ever nothing, there would still be nothing right now. Because you can't get something from nothing.
Exactly. Therefore, not everything can be an accident. There has to be at least one being that isn't contingent. One being that must exist. A necessary being.
A being whose very nature is just to exist.
Yes. A being whose very essence is to be. And this is where Aquinas pulls off his absolute genius move. He connects this dense, abstract, philosophical conclusion directly to the text of the Bible. Remember the story of the burning bush in the book of Exodus?
Right. Moses is in the desert. He sees the bush and he asks God for his name.
And what does God reply? He says, "I am that I am." For Aquinas, and specifically for the scholar Etienne Gilson, who is mentioned extensively in your source text, this is the ultimate eureka moment.
Because it matches the philosophy perfectly.
God isn't just telling Moses a mystical riddle. He's giving him a precise metaphysical definition. God is the pure act of existing itself. He isn't just a really powerful being that happens to have existence. He is existence.
That distinction between having existence as a property and literally being existence itself leads to something that really blew my mind when I was reading the source material. It's the difference between horizontal and vertical causation.
Oh, this is easily one of the most misunderstood parts of Aquinas' entire philosophy.
Because usually I think when regular people hear the phrase first cause, they immediately think of dominoes, or maybe the Big Bang. God is the guy who flicked the very first domino 14 billion years ago, and now he's off playing golf somewhere while the universe just runs itself on autopilot.
That is the deist view of God. That's horizontal causation. It's a chain stretching backward in time. God starts the clock, winds it up, and then leaves the room. Aquinas would say that is completely fundamentally wrong.
So what is vertical causation then? How is it different?
The lecture uses a really great analogy to explain this. Picture a hand using a wooden staff to push a heavy stone.
Okay. Hand, stick, stone.
Got it. The stone moves because the stick is actively pushing it. The stick is moving because the hand is actively pushing it. Now, here's the critical question. What happens if the hand suddenly stops moving?
The stick stops immediately and the stone stops immediately.
Exactly. The stick has absolutely no independent power of motion on its own. It is borrowing that power right now, in this very millisecond, from the hand. Aquinas says the entire universe is the stick.
Wow.
It's not that God gave us a push at the beginning of time and let go. It's that right now, at this very second you are breathing, God is actively keeping you and everything else in existence.
That is actually kind of terrifying to think about.
It's incredibly intense.
It means if God stopped thinking about me or stopped sustaining me for one single microsecond, I wouldn't just die. I would vanish.
Yeah.
I would just delete from reality.
You would completely cease to be. That is vertical causation. We are entirely contingent on God here and now, vertically, for our very being. It completely changes God from this distant historical architect into a sustaining, immediate presence that is literally holding every single atom together right now.
Okay, so we have established this being that is pure existence, sustaining everything vertically, but now we run into a massive language barrier.
The problem of naming God.
Right, because if we are strict empiricists, if all the words we use come from seeing dogs and cats and trees and normal stuff, how can we possibly use those normal words to describe a super being that is totally unique?
It is a huge philosophical problem. Usually we define things by a process called abstraction.
Abstraction. That's like if I see a bunch of poodles and Great Danes and terriers, I ignore the curly hair or the size, and I come up with the general concept of dog.
Right. You look at a group, you abstract the specific differences, and you find the universal essence or species. But here's the problem. God isn't in a group. There is no biological species of gods that we can observe. He is completely sui generis. He is in a class of one.
So we can't abstract him. We can't say, oh, He's like Zeus, but a little nicer and with fewer lightning bolts.
Exactly. So Aquinas says we can only truly know and speak about God by analogy, specifically something called the analogy of proportionality. And this is where the lecture gave an example that I have to admit, it made me laugh out loud when I read it.
Oh, I know exactly what you're going to say. I read it too. The California mudslide.
Yes. Dr. Holmes is explaining this, and he casually compares God, human beings, and a California mudslide.
I have to stop you there, because how on earth does a natural disaster like a mudslide help us understand the creator of the universe? That feels like a massive reach.
It does sound completely absurd at first, doesn't it? But stick with the underlying logic. He's talking about degrees of being, or degrees of perfection. A mudslide has a very, very low degree of being. It has almost no intelligible order. It's mostly just chaos, dirt, and gravity.
It's just messy. There's no structure.
Right. Now, step up the ladder to a human being. We have significantly more order, more intelligence, biological complexity, morality. Mm-hmm. We have a much higher degree of being than the mud. Now, take that scale and extend it upward infinitely. God is at the absolute top.
So it's a sliding scale of perfection.
Yes. So when we use a word and say God is good, we don't mean he's good in the exact same way a well-behaved puppy is good.
Right.
But we also don't mean something totally random and unknowable. We mean he possesses goodness in the way that is appropriate to his infinite nature, just as a human possesses goodness in the way appropriate to our finite nature. It allows us to speak meaningfully about him without dragging him down to our limited level.
This idea of a scale of being leads us directly into another concept from the deep dive that felt very foreign to me. The idea that being itself is loaded.
Loaded. How do you mean?
Well, today, in the modern world, we usually think of existence as a binary switch. You either exist or you don't. Think of Hamlet's to be or not to be. It's on or off. But Aquinas seems to think that to be comes with all these built-in accessories.
It absolutely does. For Aquinas and the medieval mindset generally, to be is an incredibly rich concept. Being is actually interchangeable with things like truth and goodness. He calls these the transcendental attributes of being.
Okay, let's unpack truth first. Because usually when I think of truth, I just think of facts. The sky is blue. That's a true statement. The sky is green. That's a false statement. How can a physical being be true?
What you're describing is epistemic truth, truth that lives in the mind as a proposition. But Aquinas is talking about ontological truth, the truth of being itself. Think about it this way. What do you mean when you call someone a true friend?
I mean, they're loyal, they have my back when things get tough.
Right. You don't mean they are a factually accurate sentence. You mean they live up to the standard of what a friend ought to be. They match the ideal. For Aquinas, God essentially holds the blueprints, the archetypes of everything in his divine mind. So a true tree is a tree that fully matches God's eternal idea of a tree.
So God is the literal anchor for reality.
Mm-hmm.
If you match his blueprint, you have ontological truth.
Exactly.
What about goodness then?
It's the exact same principle. To exist, simply to have being, is fundamentally good.
Wait, pause right there. To exist is to be good. I can think of plenty of things that exist that are definitely not good. Diseases, mosquitoes, certain politicians.
Aquinas would counter that insofar as they have being, insofar as they exist, they are good. But this obviously brings us right to the classic problem of evil. If all being is good, what exactly is evil?
Is it like a dark force, a physical substance out there in the world?
No. For Aquinas, evil is a privation. It's a lack of something that should be there. It's a hole in being.
The lecture used the rotting apple example.
Yes, that's a perfect illustration. Think about a rotting apple on the ground. It's bad, right? But why is it bad? Because it is actively losing its appleness. It is suffering a privation of its proper form. It's falling apart.
So evil isn't a new thing added to the apple. It's just the apple losing its structural integrity.
Exactly. But here's where Aquinas zooms out to the macro level. He asks, is the rotting of that specific apple bad for the universe as a whole?
Well, no, I guess not. Because the rot breaks down the fruit, it releases the seeds into the soil, and eventually we get a whole new apple tree.
Precisely. The death of the individual apple is totally necessary for the continued life of the orchard. Aquinas argues that God, in his ultimate providence, allows certain natural defects, certain evils like corruption, decay, or even predators eating prey because they serve the greater good of the entire interconnected order.
I mean, that's a bit dark, isn't it? Just, sorry, apple, you have to rot for the greater good of the orchard.
It is definitely dark from the limited perspective of the apple. But from the perspective of the grand architect, it's just part of a functioning, dynamic, living system.
But what about moral evil? humans doing terrible things to each other. It doesn't seem to grow any metaphorical apple trees.
Aquinas categorizes that as a defect of the agent. It's a misuse of human free will. He argues that God allows it because a world populated with free agents, people who can actually choose to love or choose to hate, is ultimately a far better world than a clockwork universe full of programmed robots, even if those free agents sometimes choose to crash the car.
It all comes back to this massive, tightly interconnected web of logic. It really feels like Aquinas took the cold, calculating scientific worldview of Aristotle and just injected it with ultimate meaning.
That is probably the best summary of his entire achievement. He didn't break Aristotle's logic, he expanded it. He showed that if you have the courage to follow the causal chain of the universe all the way down to the absolute bottom, you don't just find a dead magnet or a random quantum fluctuation. You find a person. You find a sustaining source that is truth and goodness itself.
Before we wrap up this deep dive, I want to leave you listening with one final thought from the lecture that I found incredibly provocative. It touches on something we haven't fully discussed yet, the debate about the best of all possible worlds.
Ah, yes. The age-old question of whether God could have done a better job.
Right. Aquinas argues that God absolutely could have made other worlds. He wasn't forced by some external rule to make this specific one. But he says that given this specific blueprint,
given this specific order that God freely chose, the way all the parts fit together is perfectly suitable and good.
It really suggests that we shouldn't look at the flaws in the world, like the rotting apple, or the pain of loss merely as mistakes on the blueprint. But rather, maybe they are necessary shadows in one very specific, intentionally chosen masterpiece. But it does leave you wondering, is this truly the best possible creation? Or is it simply the most perfect version of this one particular design?
It definitely changes how you look at reality. You stop seeing the universe as just random stuff bouncing around, and you start seeing a vast hierarchy of beings, all pointing vertical, all being held in existence right now by that invisible hand.
It certainly makes the universe feel a lot less lonely. That is a ton to process. A massive thank you to our expert for helping us hack the mind of the angelic doctor today.
Always a pleasure to unpack the really big questions with you.
And for you listening, next time you see a domino fall, or an apple rot on the ground, or even hear about a California mudslide, remember, you might just be watching the vertical hand of the creator actively at work. Keep exploring, and we'll see you on the next deep dive.